The coronavirus pandemic, which has already caused unimaginable devastation and hardship, has brought our way of life to an almost complete halt. The global struggle to slow the spread of the disease has brought with it cancelled flights, closed businesses, and a quickly escalating economic slowdown that could be devastating to millions. One side effect of this crisis is that greenhouse gas emissions, temporarily at least, have decreased. The question, of course, is will this be a temporary phenomenon only? Will emissions roar back to their usual levels when this is over? Or could it lead to a longer-lasting fall in emissions? We're going to see now if we can take some lessons from history with regard to the environment in a time of global crisis. I'm joined from New York City by Roisin Kaman, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. You're very welcome to the History Show. Now, Roisin, when you look at the 20th century as a whole, you've got two world wars, continued rapid industrialization, and huge population growth. In terms of the rate of emissions of harmful gases of various kinds and pollutants into our atmosphere, on a graph, I'd imagine you'd see a fairly steep line going upwards since, say, World War One.
So it depends on the gas that you're talking about. For things like long-lived gases like CO2, methane, we've seen a dramatic increase pretty much since the start of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s, and it's steadily increased since then. But for some pollutants, we've actually seen a drop. So after the London fog event in 1952, a lot of regulations were brought in to clean up our air, and those regulations have been at different times in different places, but in general we are seeing air get a lot cleaner for short-lived pollutants that would stress out people's respiratory tracts, if you like, whereas we're seeing a dramatic increase in the gases that we don't really notice, like CO2 and methane. We can't smell them, we can't taste them, they don't really have a human health impact, so we haven't had any reason to limit them as much until we realise the impact they were having on climate and temperature. But for the short-lived gases, we've actually seen a decrease. So we've done a pretty good job reducing the sulfur, the ozone, the NOx, the stuff that you know, if you're in London and you really can't breathe, those kind of gases.
Now, you mentioned the London smog of 1952. I'm sure a lot of people, I'm one of them, wouldn't be aware of that London smog. It killed thousands of people. Why did it come about? Why was it so deadly?
So in London, along the Thames Valley and in London itself, they had events like that from the 1600s onwards due to the fog rolling in, but then adding a lot of pollution. And in December 1952, over the course of about 5 days, the pollution was so bad you couldn't see across the street. But it meant that over time, I think about 4,000 people were killed pretty soon after, but they think about 10,000 people in total died, and over 100,000 were made really, really sick. And the political fallout from that was pretty much the first Air Quality Act, Clean Air Act, if you like, that was ever enacted. And that was in, I think, 56, whereas it took until later for places like the US to start bringing in things like that. But yeah, it had a huge effect on people, but I don't think people realized at the time how many people would die. It had been happening, but it was just such a large event and so many people died at the same time that it became a really big problem.
I think it featured in an episode of the TV series The Crown. And was it all down purely and simply to burning coal?
So it was the sulfur from the coal. So people were burning it in houses, but factories were also using it for fuel. And it was the combination of both of those meant that there was a lot of sulfur in the air, as well as other things. But the sulfur itself caused the particulates to form, so the aerosols. When we talk about smog now, it doesn't have that kind of sulfur loading, thankfully. So when you see something like Los Angeles, they have smog events, but they're not loaded with a lot of particles. They're actually formed photochemically. Take all the chemicals, add some sunlight, which they have a lot of in LA, and then you get this smog forming. But it's not quite as dangerous as the very heavy sulfur fog.
Now, the Great Smog of London happened way back in 1952, so almost 70 years ago at this stage. But incredibly, in New York, where you're based, they were still using fuel with high levels of sulfur as recently as just a few years ago.
The law changed in 2015. I arrived here in 2018 and I went, what? I mean, Yeah, so it just shows that just because we think we're learning things in some areas does not mean that everybody got the memo. It does not mean that everybody realized. So New York until 2015 was allowing the burning of high sulfur sludge fuel. People started changing when they knew the law was going to be enacted. And the air quality in New York has dramatically improved for sulfur, for SO2 and particulates over the past 5, 6, 10 years maybe. And most of that is driven by stuff that was brought in London in the 50s. And I just cannot believe it. They also have 24 power plants within the city limits, where every other city I've ever lived in has moved power plants away from where people live. In New York, there's one on Manhattan. I mean, the price of the property alone, I don't understand why they are here. There's a law about providing enough power to the city. That means that half of the power for the city has to be generated within the city limits. And it came from riots in the 70s when power outages were quite common and the transmission lines were just failing. So I can understand where it's coming from, but nothing has changed since then. So now the pollution is generated in the city when no other city I know of generates their power within the city limits.
Now, at the moment, because of what is essentially economic stagnation, we are seeing changes in pollution patterns over certain countries, China, Italy, for example. But go back to the 1970s, you had an element of economic stagnation there caused by the oil crisis, caused by the Arab nations targeting a number of countries like the USA and Britain, for example. A crisis with a huge effect on the global economy, one that caused an interest in conservation and renewable energy. But did it have any long-term effects when it came to emissions and the environment, or was it just a tiny blip on the radar?
So for CO2, one of the longest measurement sites, it's at Mauna Loa. It's a mountain on the islands of Hawaii, and it is a pretty good site to look at the global integrated signal. So it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about something right now, but it gives you the overall impact on the atmosphere maybe 6 months later. And for 73, 74, you barely see a blip. It does stop going up quite as much, but it never, in the entire record I've been looking at back to the 60s, I've never seen a drop over that time period. We do see a change in how quickly it's increasing. The CO2 in the atmosphere is increasing. And for, say, 73, we see a drop for the Iran oil crisis. We see a bigger drop in, say, the 90s as the Soviet Union was collapsing. And then we also had a natural event where Mount Pinatubo in 92 put a lot of sulfur and aerosol into the stratosphere. And that has a much bigger effect than any of the economic changes so far. We've constantly see the CO2 going up. And even for Pinatubo, we see it flatten. We don't see it drop. We're still emitting CO2. We're still putting a lot of it into the atmosphere. And the oceans absorb maybe 40, 50% of it. The rest of it ends up in the atmosphere causing warming. So what we're looking at in the atmosphere is the leftover. We're not even seeing the whole emission. Anything the ocean takes up is already gone by the time we see it in the atmosphere. And yet we're never seeing it drop. Even for the 2008, 2009, things slowed. And it kind of almost got level. And since about 2010, the increase rate has been way more than every other year I've looked at before that. So at the moment, we're talking about 2 to 3 parts per million increase per year. So this is the fastest increase in CO2 in the atmosphere that we have ever seen on record in the past 10 years.
Discouraging news indeed. One of your areas of expertise is atmospheric chemistry and atmospheric measurements. And you've taught something about the history of the famous ozone hole. Take us back to 1987 and the Montreal Protocol, the treaty designed to protect the ozone layer.
The Montreal Protocol kind of went over my head at the time because I was in, I don't know, seniors, first class. And it's only since I've been making a lot of atmospheric measurements that I started to talk to the people that were actually involved at the time. So it had been proposed in the 70s by Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland that CFCs, which at the time were hailed to be this amazing chemical that would never cause any damage. It would never degrade. They would live for thousands of years, so they were no way reactive, which at the time was perfect. What we didn't know was that if you put them up in the stratosphere where the wavelengths of light are very different to what we see at the surface, you get a lot more UV radiation, and you add some very cold surfaces, suddenly they would become reactive. And what they do is they catalytically destroy ozone, and it's what filters out much of the UVA and UVB that causes skin damage. So when you're in an area where, so in Chile, the rates of skin cancer have gone way up over the past 30 years as the CFCs have made the ozone hole bigger and bigger. So they are seeing a lot less stratospheric ozone. So they're seeing a lot more UV radiation at the surface. That's oftentimes why Australia and New Zealand are very careful about having hats on when they're outside. They see a lot more UV radiation coming in than we would in, say, Ireland. And it does make a difference. It does cause a lot more skin cancer. So chatting with them about it, it was very interesting to see that for CFCs, they had been trying to get this conference going for quite a while. And then in 1985, it was noticed that ozone was dropping over Antarctica. Nobody believed that Sherry Rowland and Mario Molina were right. It was a really interesting paper, but to most people, it was theory. And it wasn't until the British Antarctic Survey measurements in Antarctica started seeing the ozone drop that people began to take it seriously. That paper was published in 1985, and by 1986, NASA had a flight campaign over Antarctica, figuring out what exactly was going on, and it pinpointed the CFCs that were in the stratosphere as the major source of this chlorine that was destroying the ozone. So by 1987, when the Montreal Protocol was signed, there was a lot of goodwill and consensus that wanted that agreement signed. Now, I often asked, you know, did you guys get really lucky? What was going on? It turns out that there were only 14 manufacturers of these CFCs globally. And many of them already had replacements that they were more than happy to swap in to replace these CFCs pretty much straight away. So the industry was happy and fine for these CFCs to be phased out and a different type of chemical that wouldn't get to the stratosphere could be used instead. So that's often, I kind of wonder about the comparison with climate change, and that is the one thing. There was only 14 of them to negotiate with. Now, for something like nitrous oxide, so laughing gas, that's two nitrogens and an oxygen. That's also a very strong ozone-depleting substance. It eats up the ozone when it gets to the stratosphere, and that has been increasing, not quite at the same rate of CO2, but pretty quickly as well. And yet we have no way to figure out how we're going to reduce that because it's a byproduct of fertilizer application in farming and it comes from many different sources. So we can't deal with 14 producers that are happy to deal with alternatives. We have to figure out how we're going to reduce this in a very, very different way. And the ozone hole last year, I think, was the first time it stopped growing. So we got rid of these chemicals in 1987, 88. By 1990, most of them were no longer being emitted, but they have a very long lifetime. And the ozone hole has been growing ever since. We think we have it fixed, but it's only this year and last year, the year before, that it's finally stopped getting bigger. It's not even that it's getting that much smaller yet. It will over time, but that's the kind of time lag we're looking at for a lot of these species that we pump into the atmosphere.
So, Roisin, even these blips on the radar, one of which we're going through at the moment, I suppose, the ones we've been talking about, like the 1970s oil crisis, like the 2008 recession, like the coronavirus crisis, short-term effects, do they demonstrate what is possible when it comes to climate action, or do they underscore the kind of difficulties that we're facing?
I think it's a combination of both. So for the short-lived gases like pollutants, we can see now the impact they have. And even as somebody who measures, I measure CO2, yet figuring out how that impacts me is quite difficult. And I work on this every single day. Whereas if I go outside and I can suddenly breathe when I go for a run, that's a tangible difference. And most of the combustion sources for CO2 that we're looking at in cities, they also give off the things that make it hard to breathe. So I think it is showing us what's possible in that I have never seen New York so clean. It's actually really pleasant to go for a walk right now. I'm not smothered by trucks and cars as I walk on the footpath. But at the same time, we can get the same air quality improvements without the economic impacts if we enact the right policies. So what I'd really like is going forward that we consider the whole. So every source of CO2 is a source of pollution. How much pollution? And can we make sure that when we're trying to improve, we're trying to reduce the amount of carbon emissions, because we need to, things are warming up awfully quickly. Can we also make sure that we're improving the air quality, the tangible stuff for right now, that will make things a lot more pleasant to live in? I mean, it's up to people to ask for whatever they want to happen. If you prefer this nice, cleaner air, start asking for it. And I mean, that'll depend on the country you're in, how you go about that. But it is something that we're going to have to start demanding if we want cleaner air and we want less carbon in the atmosphere. And the two, I think, are very closely linked, and yet often in the media, they're not. Yet they are the same sources.
If I can finish on a personal note, you're based in New York, the current epicenter of the coronavirus crisis. How are you faring?
I'm good. It's been interesting to work at home. My cat is delighted to have me and then sick of me at the same time. So I work at Columbia University, and they pretty much closed as soon as the city said to close. So I'm used to a lot of field campaigns. I often go away for like 2 months at a time with one suitcase, and that's it. I know what I'm doing for 2 months, which means I'm quite fine with this, to be honest. I mean, I'm in a little bubble. I'm perfectly safe. I have a grocery store nearby. I can get coffee. You know, it's no hassle for me, but it's the not knowing when it's going to end. So as long as they still let us exercise, I think I'll be fine. If we start getting restrictions on exercise, that could be a lot tougher, I think. I think it's more in Queens, so further east in New York are pretty bad. I've had a lot of friends who've had it and recovered okay, but in the area I'm in near the university, it's very international anyway, so many of those people are like European and South American, so there hasn't been that many people from New York, but then again, most people in New York are not from New York, so we'll see how it all goes. I'm hoping the best for everybody. I have a cousin working as a nurse here in New York at the moment, and it's been stressful, but she says they're getting there. They're now getting to the stage where they have what they need, in her hospital anyway.
Well, stay safe and stay healthy, Róisín. Róisín Kamán, many thanks for joining us this evening from your home in New York, in West Harlem, to talk to us about your work and how crises can have that short-term positive effect on the environment. And we hope that this crisis will help us turn a corner in cutting planet warming pollution. Róisín, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Logan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.